My name is Ramin Barani, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Adam Shartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio. You're listening to episode number 501. I hope you enjoyed the last episode with Ramin Barani. I just had a blast finally getting him on the podcast. There's nothing more gratifying than months and months of trying to schedule in a new guest and it finally working out and then having such a nice time. So another thank you to Ramin Barani for gracing this podcast with this podcast's 500th episode. Thank you very kindly to Ramin Barani. This is episode 501. We're celebrating two documentaries. One goes back to 1982, and one is coming out in 2018. The Atomic Cafe was, probably one of the most groundbreaking films of its day, and even right now. I mean, it just was re-released. The Film Forum just reopened less than 2 weeks ago. They opened their doors again after a three-month hiatus where they renovated and added a fourth screen. And in that fourth screen, for another day or so, this podcast episode is going up on Monday, the 13th. Through Tuesday, the 14th, you could still see the Atomic Cafe in this beautiful 4K restoration. And I urge you to do so. And we're going to have on the filmmakers for that famous documentary. By the way, if you don't live in New York, there will be more theaters around the country that will be screening the film in the coming days. So I urge you to Google the Atomic Cafe and keep in touch with screenings near you. Everyone should see the Atomic Cafe, and everyone should see it on a big screen. We will be talking in our second segment to Kevin Rafferty, Jane Loader, and Pierce Rafferty, the three filmmakers who directed it, edited it, produced it. It's an incredible film. But first, we are lucky to have Bing Lui, who is the director of a very personal documentary called Minding the Gap. We're going to go into that conversation with this filmmaker in a moment. I saw the film at BAM Cinema Fest. I had already heard about it and tried to see it sooner, but just didn't have the opportunity. So I was glad to see it at BAM maybe a month and a half ago. So I was looking forward to bringing Bing onto the podcast. And fortunately, it has worked out, and you're about to hear that. I mean, all I can tell you about this is a very brief description here. Three young men bond together to escape volatile families in their Rust Belt hometown of Rockford, Illinois. As they face adult responsibilities, unexpected revelations threaten their decade-long friendship. One of the three young men is Bing himself, and he's going to talk about making the film with us. Also working with Kartemquin. Kartemquin Films, a longtime friend of this podcast, is a collaborative center for documentary media makers who seek to foster a more engaged and empowered society. If you live in the Chicago area you make documentaries or want to, I would advise you to make contact with Kartemquin Films, to look up Kartemquin and find out who they are and what they do. Longtime friend Steve James, who has made such films as Hoop Dreams and The Interrupters and Life Itself, just to name a few films, is associated with there. A friend of the podcast, Laura Checkaway, has who's been on this show a couple of times. She has made her films with the help of Kartemquin Films, and they are aboard the team of Minding the Gap. So see that. Bing Lui is a Chicago-based director and cinematographer who Variety magazine listed as one of 10 documentary filmmakers to watch. Minding the Gap has earned over 29 award recognitions since its world premiere at the 2018 Sundance Film Festival, where it took the Special Jury Award for Breakthrough Filmmaking. He also directed three storylines on America to Me, which we're going to talk about, a 10-hour documentary series from Steve James that examines racial inequities in the U.S. education system, and which will be airing on Stars momentarily. So we're going to be talking to Bing right now here on FilmWax Radio. And Minding the Gap opens in New York at the Metrograph Theater on Friday, August the 17th. I urge you to see this documentary. It is moving, it is powerful, and we have the filmmaker Bing Louie right here on FilmWax Radio right now.
Take one.
I'm making this film because I saw myself in your story.
I always felt like I didn't fit in with my family.
My parents ran this very controlling house. I ran away a lot.
Skateboarding is more of a family than my family.
How did you get disciplined?
I mean, well, they call it child abuse now, but...
Life might be moving too fast. We have to fully grow up, and it's gonna suck.
When you're a kid, you just do, you just act. And then somewhere along the line, everyone loses that.
I knew you had some huge weight on you. Skateboarding meant more to you. It was kind of a life or death thing.
I remember hearing screaming coming from your room, and it was like really, really unnerving.
One of the last things I said to my dad was that I hate you.
You can't just have a child and abandon them. Life doesn't work like that.
I just don't want him to grow up like me. I just want to hide. I just want to run away. That's what the drink is.
Okay, yeah, so we're recording. Awesome. Let me just hear you say whatever. We're in a noisy venue, so they just want to be on the podcast too.
Yeah, I think they're, you know, this is their 15 minutes. Yeah.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Not bad. I saw Minding the Gap at BAM Cinema Fest.
Oh, cool. Yeah. That was a great screening. It was, yeah.
I wasn't at that one, though.
Oh, you weren't. You were at the press.
I was at a press screening.
Gotcha.
But I saw it on the same screen.
Oh, in the same room.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, they have it in the same room.
Were there a lot of people there?
Yeah.
You don't have to tell me.
It was packed. For a press screening, it was packed. No, there were. There was a nice turnout.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Awesome.
And what I was also intrigued by, we'll get to the subject matter, but is also your collaboration with Kartem Quinn.
Yes.
Who is, you know, been an ongoing friend of the show. So I don't know how else to describe them, because I've had on Steve James... he's like a pal at this stage. He's been
three times you've had Steve on?
He might have been on this podcast times. Well, most recently with Abacus. And then we just came on for a really long chat at one point. And I think we met once for...
Has he met his limit? Is that
yeah,
the quota for no more Steve?
He's definitely not invited back. Unless he makes another film, which I know... Oh, actually doing a TV thing, right?
Now? Well, I worked in that. I directed three stories in that.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
So...
There's 12 high school students. And in 2015, he hired me to direct three stories.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah, and then Laura Checkaway, do you know her?
Edith and Eddie, yeah, I met her. We had ramen last time I was here.
Ramen? Okay, yeah. Well, we should order some ramen, too. Is it on the menu? Are you based in Chicago?
I'm based in Chicago. I've been there for 10 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you grew up in not too far.
Hour and a half west. Yeah.
Oh, okay, very good. You had to ask for a cappuccino.
Yeah.
Son of a gun.
She's bitch, yeah, sorry. That's my fault.
It's all right.
It's grinding the beans.
It's okay. I think you're coming through loud and clear. So you grew up in Rockford.
Yeah.
Rockford.
Yeah.
Rockford, Illinois, and got into the skateboarding scene as a way of integrating, of meeting people and making friends. Is that how you originally got into it, do you think? Or was it an escape?
I think it was an escape. Mm-hmm. It was an escape. For the first, 6 months of doing it was, winter, and I was, doing it in my basement by myself.
Yeah.
And then I slowly met kids in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And then I, started getting better, and then I met more kids. And then I got a camera, and I really met more kids. I, went around the country in, a van, So, yeah, it really saved my life and changed the course of my life. Yeah.
Okay. How do you think... it may have turned out if you hadn't gotten into skateboarding.
A lot of the other, maybe a lot of the young people in town who were of, my background, probably would have done more drugs than I did.
Okay.
Probably, wouldn't have found the same sort of sense of control with my life, and maybe I wouldn't have moved out of Rockford. Maybe I wouldn't have graduated high school.
But it was a combination of other things as well, because obviously some of the other guys, two of whom are also covered in the film. That's nice. Thank you.
The cappuccino's arrived, just to let listeners know.
No slurping on the show. It's okay. A slurp-free zone here.
Oh, man.
No, go ahead. We can wait it out. You should enjoy it while it's fresh and hot. No, don't be all up in this business here.
It's good.
Noah's been helping a great deal. He's interning for FilmWax. But because there's two other men who are... also, who you follow their stories in Minding the Gap.
Yeah, Zach and Kier.
Zach and Kier. So you have a nice diverse trio of people.
Kier is African American. Mm-hmm. Zach is white. I'm Chinese American.
Yeah, and you discover through the film, as you did obviously the making of the film, being on the other side of the camera, that you had a lot in common, or you have several things in common that mm-hmm. emerged through the telling and things you noticed, and then this creates the theme of the film. Mm-hmm. But it seems like you found your way into a healthy life. Maybe I'm not describing it well, but you found something that gave you a real strong, you know, reason and motivation for having a healthy life. Mm-hmm. And I think it seems like it might have been a combination of the filmmaking as well, you know, as storytelling. Mm-hmm. And you also had a very, very caring and nurturing mother in the end.
Yes and no. I didn't see a lot of my mom growing up. She was nurturing, I was born in China. Mm-hmm. My mom was going to school at the time when I was born in Beijing. And then I got a lot of care from her parents and also my father's parents.
Oh, I see.
Then she moved to Alabama to go to school. And then my father and I followed her to go there. And then my mom and dad divorced. And then it was just me and my mom. But she was just working and going to school, so I was left home alone a lot.
You were a lot, okay.
And then I moved to L.A. with her, and it was sort of the same deal. I was a latchkey kid.
Mm-hmm.
Then moved to Rockford. She met this stepfather who is, you know,
right.
ends up being a big part of the film, just in the background, though.
Mm-hmm.
And then she just kept working, and so, mm-hmm. like, I didn't, you know.
Does she support your filmmaking, for instance?
She loaned me some money to buy my first camera off eBay for a couple $100.
Okay.
But I was also working as a dishwasher at the time, and you know, so it was,
yeah.
But yeah, she didn't prevent me from doing the things that I wanted to do. Like she bought me my first skateboard, for example, for Christmas. So
did she know you already had a passion for that, or did she just do it because she thought it was be a hobby for you?
She probably thought it was going to be a hobby, as I feel like most parents do, did back then. I think it's probably different now. You have parents taking paying hundreds of dollars for kids to go to skate camp and stuff now.
Right.
But yeah, I think she probably thought it was a hobby. I mean, I started when I was in seventh grade, I sat next to this kid in literature class, and I liked him because he would draw like sketches of Barney and the Teletubbies smoking weed. You know, mm-hmm. I thought, oh, this guy's interesting. Yeah. And then he would bring this finger skateboard to the class, you know, this tech deck. I don't know if you guys know these toy skateboards are.
Yeah, they're little ones
fingers.
That come like six
yeah.
in a pack.
So he would like do tricks with on the literature book.
Uh-huh.
And that's what drew me to skateboarding at first.
Interesting. Yeah, no, I have a little kid. You know, he's 14 now, so I guess he's... So you there's skateboard camp. I didn't even think of that. I guess it's there are going to be those who kind of can figure out how to exploit.
Skateboarding has become so corporate now.
Yeah.
You know, it's like all like Nike and Adidas and all the big shoe companies and are like there's no more independent skate shoe companies anymore. And it's about to become in the Olympics. I mean, so I think there's this. Mm. You know, it's destigmatized now. Parents see the value of it.
What do you see? What do you make of that? Because you came from a very different.
I think there's little benefit in resisting change, and I also think like I'm not worried because skateboarding is sort of like Bitcoin, like it just builds on itself and there's no central authority figure, and you're never gonna take away that core sort of gritty, you know, skateboarding culture that is gonna be present in like the small town skate park where this kid has duct tape shoes and he's skating for the love of it and he's doing it to escape a dark family life perhaps, you know.
Yeah.
Like that aspect's never gonna go away, you know.
Well,
in skateboarding.
And I don't want to give the wrong impression to those listening, because the skateboarding, even though it's very much the backdrop of the film, it really isn't getting to the core of what the film is about.
Yeah, I thought
it is only
I really like the film Kids growing up.
I know.
And it was because it was it wasn't about skateboarding. It just existed in the skateboarding world. You know?
And this could have been in another environment too. Themes that run through of being a young man without the someone who is guiding you, like a male father figure that's you know, a good father figure, or very available and present and emotionally available to you and guiding you in that positive way. You're all kind of struggled with that figure, whether you know, in your life. The three of you, correct?
Yeah, that was sort of the genesis. Well, so I started this project in my mid-20s and reverse engineered it, you know, to make it seem like I started when I was 14. But, you know, the seed of this project is very much like me wanting to explore, you know, what it meant for skateboarders to have poor relationships to their fathers. And so I went around the country and, you know, filmed all these skateboarders. And then a year into it, I met Kier and I was like, oh, this guy's so special.
Yeah.
And Zach was about to become a father. And then, you know, I had actually known Zach, though, from my teenage years. And so he was someone that I wasn't, like, really getting to know for the first time.
Where was Kier living or growing up?
He was in Rockford. Everyone was in Rockford.
They were.
Yeah.
So you, even though you went around the country, as you said, shooting various folks, you ended up coming home.
Yeah, it's funny.
Being in this microcosm regardless.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, I remember I went out to Portland like three times to follow up with this one character.
Right?
I went to St. Louis multiple times to follow this other character. And I think it's probably out of expediency. But it's also because things were happening. Like, Zach had this child and things weren't going well. And, you know, I think I slowly skimmed the fat, so to speak, and kept going back to Rockford to follow Kier and Zach.
Yeah. Well, they're both so... all three of you are so compelling. And I think almost any person could relate to what you guys are going through, and it just creates an empathy from every, you know, I think that's why so many people are connecting with your film.
Yeah, it's rare to see like true intimacy and vulnerability in young men.
I think so.
He's given
he's been watching it too. We got him a link too, so he could watch. I try to trying to throw as many films.
And who, this is your assistant?
Yeah, this is Noah. He's interning this summer for Filmwax.
Gotcha.
I do the podcast. I do other things as well, but primarily he's been helping with that.
Gotcha.
And he goes to SUNY Purchase, and he's sitting very closely.
He's taking photos and videos.
He's great.
Yeah, how's your internship going? You can mime it. You want to mime it? He says very well.
It's going great.
Thanks.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
I hope he's learning some things, and you know, he's helping with a number of other things. So it ended up being all in the Rockford area, as it just coincidentally, or it made the most sense for whatever reason. But it helps because, you know, you've created this kind of world, this space that after like an hour and a half, 2 hours, we're feeling like we're getting a kind of an understanding of it. And
yeah, it was really important for me to find a way to show Rockford, because I think people that aren't from the Chicagoland area, you know, I think they think Rockford is just like a vanilla suburb, but it's not. It's a Rust Belt city that, you know, is more like Flint, Michigan than it is like, you know, like Evanston or Arlington Heights, you know.
So it's gone through its rough periods because of the disappearance of manufacturing and
industry
abandonment, right, by big companies. And
yeah, and also interestingly enough, the tearing down of the Chicago high-rise projects in the 90s.
Sure.
So a lot of residents were moved to Rockford after that. So,
but getting back, by the way, you mentioned kids as being an influence, and I noticed that in reading about you, and that you seem Harmony Korine and also Richard Linklater were both influences, both Austin-based, by the way.
Oh, I thought Harmony was in Nashville. Or now he's in Miami, but I thought he grew up in Nashville.
He has
an affinity with the South, and he's talked about that.
All right. Well, maybe he wasn't. The times I've seen him were in Austin, but it could have been because it was during South by Southwest, too. But I just thought he was living there for a while. But he might have been.
He's very much grew up as a skateboarder himself. So
sure.
You know, we're all very itinerant people.
Yeah. And what is it about the Linklater films that you liked?
It was less like all his films. It was more the movie Waking Life and Slacker. Like, I didn't even realize Dazed and Confused was his film growing up, you know. I thought it was just like another one of those like cult classics.
Right. And it was.
But Waking Life was, it like really got at the sort of curiosity that's sort of emotional and earnest and almost angsty that I feel like perhaps a lot of young men feel. I just certainly felt it, and it was sort of showed a way of trying to answer things that were, you know, that sort of alluded to questions that were becoming more and more important to someone growing up as a teenager. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was just, it was kind of like a lonesome film too. It just really got at emotionally and intellectually at the same time, like what I felt like represented me growing up. And I feel like Mind in the Gap was sort of this interrogative thing. That's what it felt like at the beginning, where I run around the country and like had my own waking life experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then Slacker, like one of my first films I made when I was 17, that was not a skateboarding film, you know, it sort of emulated Slacker. Like I felt, and I feel like many people felt when Slacker came out, it really captured this sort of like outsider slice of populations in cities in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
But in the 2000s, I felt like, you know, there was these freaks and geeks in my community that I really wanted to showcase. So mm-hmm. I just took a bunch of my friends, none of them skated, but, you know, I had them walk around town and have these conversations about their lives and, you know.
Mm-hmm. So was that scripted or no? It was improv, but it was set up.
Yeah. But, you know, it was like, you know, this person's going to bump into, this person's going to get hit by a car and he's going to meet mm-hmm. this person, but you guys could just talk about what, just be yourself. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the film Minding the Gap, it's coming out through Magnolia and Hulu. Correct?
Yes.
So I guess that Magnolia setting up the theatricals.
It's Magnolia. I'm learning all this business insider stuff now. Hulu is
high time.
So Hulu is going to release it, and they did a service deal with Magnolia, and then POV will broadcast it next year.
Oh, it's going to be POV on the next season.
Yeah,
POV, oh, very good.
I think it'll be like an off season screening of this season in early next year.
Uh-huh.
They haven't announced an official date, but it'll be next year, earlier than later.
Okay, and where do you go from here? I mean, where do you live currently anyway? Are you in Chicago, you said?
I'm in Chicago.
So you're in the city now?
Yeah, I've moved to Chicago when I was 19.
Okay.
And I'm 29 now. But I've been developing this project with Davis Guggenheim's company, Concordia.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it follows this program that's in Chicago that is sort of helping young men escape these lives of gun violence. But the project itself is very much about memory and how difficult memory is to access when you've experienced trauma mm-hmm. in your life.
Mm-hmm.
But how important ultimately it is to sort of understand yourself and move forward. So we follow these guys, get like a certified trade and, you know, through this program over the course of 6 to 9 months, while at the same time truly understanding both their personal history and their you know, the community's history.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Very ambitious.
It's a pretty big, it's very personal and macro. And I think that's sort of going to be the challenge of this project.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the
America to Me.
No, well, you can talk about that too. That was an earlier.
It's released in August 24th on Starz. And it's 10 hours long. And it took a team of Steve James and three other story directors.
That's the series we were mentioning at the beginning.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. America to Me, right. Okay, and it's going to be on Starz.
It's going
to
be
cable
on Starz, yeah.
Okay.
It's one of the most diverse high schools in the Chicago area, but it's in a suburb of Chicago. And it's not underfunded. They've got millions of dollars in the coffers. But the question is, why is the achievement gap between black and white students not only bigger than the state average and national average, but growing bigger?
Did you get to the bottom of it, you feel like, or like a handle on it? You don't have to say what it is.
Let me just say this. We have like such a macro and micro look at how an education system works in the school that's very much a microcosm for American education, because there's 4,000 people in this school. And we followed 12 students of various backgrounds and races, teachers, administrators. We have access to board meetings. So you see how top-level decisions trickle mm-hmm. down into how teachers teach and how students ultimately experience their lives and how, you know, their parents play a role at home mm-hmm. with how well they do. So
look forward to it. I don't have Starz, but we'll get... When is it
August
broadcast?
August 24th.
Just in a matter of days. It's stepping right on your premiere.
It's very interesting. Steve just loves to take all the, you know,
suck all the oxygen out of the room with his ego.
Just kidding, Steve.
we love Steve, and I'll have to get some sort of link. I don't think I have stars. I don't know.
You reach out to Steve. I mean, I'll reach out to him. If he wants to come on for a fourth time.
Also, by the way, what's his... Tim has been on this podcast as well.
So. Oh, wow. Tim Horsburgh.
Thank you, Horsburgh. Tim. A lot about Kurt Temkin. It was right at the time of the 50th anniversary, last year.
Yeah.
So we met, and he's a fan of what I'm doing. So, I should somehow...
If he can get through his sarcasm, I think that's...
Yeah. Isn't he British, or...
He's
British.
He like grew up all of it. He's British.
Yeah,
I think he like grew up in India.
Or something. He's got to be with that last name of his.
He's very well. His humor is very British.
It is. Yeah. Dry and acerbic and whatever. Anyway, right. Well, I feel like we're just kind of getting started, but it's a good place to stop. We're going to tell people to go out and see "Minding the Gap," which I was lucky enough to see recently, and very moving and powerful documentary, and very personal, I should add, and it's premiering. Theatrically.
It's in New York. It's at the Metrograph.
At the Metrograph. I thought I saw that.
On the 17th. Yeah, which is a really cool, really cool theater. And then there's, in LA, it'll be the Lemley.
Which one?
Do we know? In Santa Monica.
Film Center? Oh, the Monica Film Center,
I don't know. Is that the Monica Film Center? The Lemley? I just know it as the Lemley.
So. Yeah. There's like 10 Lemleys over there.
Yeah. Well, it's in Santa Monica. It's like the independent Santa Monica theater. Yeah.
Those listening know what we're talking about and that are from there. So that's all that matters. And that's on the 24th or is that the 17th
as well?
That's the 17th. The 17th. Okay. August 17th as well. And then I'm sure it's going to go a bit wider, I assume.
Well, yeah, it'll be in Chicago, Austin, Seattle. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, make sure it plays in Chicago, for God's sake.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's nice meeting you.
It's nice meeting you as well.
All right. Take care. That's good.
Cool.
There's a satellite dish bolted on the house next door. It's not even hooked up, the cord's just dangling. You've seen this before. All that information, I just can't hold on to it. My mind is not a sieve, my mind's a conduit. Small electric waves surround all living things. Some call it a halo or an aura. It's just the feeling when I'm singing. How am I to know when everything is right? When I'm barreling through this world, running every red light.
Hey, music on this episode of the podcast is brought to you by one of my favorite musicians. His name is Mike Viola. Sometimes he's Mike Viola and the Candy Butchers, and sometimes he's just Candy Butchers. But go seek out the music. He's one of the most talented singers and songwriters I know. Mike has a new album called The American Egypt, which you can download off of iTunes, and I recommend it. But look him up and just see for yourself. I stand behind this. And not only that, but I'm proud to say that Mike will be on this podcast very shortly as a guest. In the meantime, enjoy some of his music on this episode.
No Robert Frost, my rhyme's too janky. No Jack and Coke on the rocks. No Christmas card from Banksy. Show me the way to stop all this buffering from the traps we set by mistake.
Armageddon has never been so darkly funny as in the Atomic Cafe. This 1982 cult classic juxtaposes Cold War history, propaganda, music, and culture, seamlessly crafted from government-produced educational and training films, newsreels, and advertisements. Taken together, these sources cheerily instruct the public on how to live in the atomic age, how to survive a nuclear attack, and how to fight and win a nuclear war. As the U.S. Army training film advises, viewed from a safe distance, the atomic bomb is one of the most beautiful sights ever seen by man. Returning to theaters in a sparkling 4K digital restoration created by Indie Collect, The Atomic Cafe is an absurdist blast from the past that would be downright laughable if it weren't so eerily relevant to our fake news present. No fucking kidding. Thank you to Kino Lorber for distributing this film theatrically, and I might add, on DVD soon, And may I also add that this conversation, which you're about to hear, will also be included on bonus content on the DVD release. So I was very proud to talk to filmmakers Kevin Rafferty, Gene Loder, and Pierce Rafferty with the Atomic Cafe here on Film Wax, Film Wax Radio.
Don't worry about yourselves. You'll be okay.
Hey, did you see that city where the first atomic bomb was dropped?
Yes, Fred.
It was a shambles, huh?
A shambles? It looked like Ebbets Field after a doubleheader with the Giants.
Well, I guess there's nothing for us to worry about. We're the ones that have the bomb.
Attention, attention.
We interrupt our normal program in the
United States is under nuclear attack.
In the background was the growing struggle between two great powers to shape the post-war world. A Cold War.
Enemy aircraft are...
We should use the atomic bomb in Korea. We could destroy men, contaminate them.
Now listen, kids. If they're dropping an atomic bomb, we'll wait about a minute after it's all over. Then we'll go upstairs and take a look around.
A new housing development near Denver, Colorado, shows the nation's first model homes with built-in fallout shelters. It may be just what the harried housewife is looking for.
It's the drink that you don't pour. Now when you take one sip, you won't need any more. As small as a beetle, as big as a wheel. Boom! Atomic cocktail.
They must be ready every day, all the time. First, you duck. And then, you cover. Under the table. It's a bomb. Duck and cover.
This is not a haphazard maneuver.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1...
About the atomic bomb, but nobody's worried about the day my Lord will come, when he'll hit great God Almighty like an atom bomb, when he comes, when he comes.
And by the way, do you know exactly what your family would do if an attack came? Say at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. It's a good question, isn't it?
All right, 2 seconds, Jane. Maybe just introduce yourself and what your role with the film is by way of a test.
Jane Loder. I was a filmmaker on The Atomic Cafe. Kevin and I cut it.
You didn't hear your dulcet tones.
Well, I'm here to say that we seem to be here before, you know, Lorber has arrived.
It's true. And last but not least, Kevin.
My name is...
It is early.
I know what my own name is. So just give me a minute. Wait. I got a letter today.
Okay. Kevin Rafferty, also. Are you all essentially co-directors as well as other roles?
Yes.
But is that okay? Even though I saw Atomic Cafe years ago, I rewatched the other day, but I just want to make sure I didn't miss any salient points about it. But we're all here together, Pierce Rafferty, Jane Loder, and Kevin Rafferty, to talk about a new 4K restoration, which is currently being screened at the 4K Restored Film Forum.
Yes.
I assume you saw it already there. And how was that experience? Anybody can answer. And just Kevin.
Well, it's great. You know, it looks better than it ever has.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm seeing things in it that I never saw before.
Is that right?
From the 35mm prints. I mean, because when they do the digital restoration, they go directly from the original negative. And it's you don't lose quality from the various generations you get when you do film printing. Mm-hmm. So it looks great.
And it sounds really good, too. Oh, yeah. The sound, that's sound something people sounds better.
That's something people don't normally talk about because we're also caught up with the film, you know, and the restoration and the preservation of film. So we don't normally think about the soundtrack as being an essential part of that restoration as well. That's a good point.
And that theater really has a great sound system there. When Kevin said directly from the original negative, he didn't mean the original negative that we found. He meant the cut A and B rolls that we had assembled, our original negative.
Okay.
We didn't go back to our original source material. We supplied our elements, and then they digitized them. That's it. There's a difference. You know?
We did more color correction on this version than we did when we did the 35 blow up from the 16. So, it, you know, we were able to sit there with the colorist and really tell them what it was supposed to look like, and it was a good experience.
Okay, I want to take a step back for those who don't know about the Atomic Cafe, and I will go over a little bit of this in the my introduction, which is going to be recorded separately. That Atomic Cafe, which came out, what year?
82.
And this was essentially, you're telling the story of the whole period from Cold War, essentially, and the bomb scare. I mean, the scare of nuclear power and of the nuclear bomb.
From the development of the bomb.
Yes.
Through that period.
Okay. All done through archive?
Right. U.S. government propaganda films would be the main motherload of material that's in the Atomic Cafe. Training films for the Army, public information films that were meant to be seen by the public, like Duck and Cover, instructing school children what to do in case of atomic attack.
And you see the flash.
Yep. There are quite a few newsreels. And television commercial in one case, a whole variety of things. But the main thing is that we used no narration, and it was a movie made without a camera or a microphone. So it's all found material.
Right. And just what was your relationship before you did this film? You guys met knowing each other, being in the industry?
I had an interesting way of meeting these guys. I was working for 7 Days magazine in New York, and my editor,
I remember that magazine.
Peter Biskin, who you may know,
Peter
sent me down to Washington, D.C., where Pierce and Kevin and our other partner, Stuart, were all living. And I was there to interview Kevin for an article about his first movie, Hurry Tomorrow, which he made with Richard Cohen. And so I met them in the course of my work. Of course, they knew each other already.
These guys are brothers. You're not cousins, you're brothers.
No, we're brothers.
Okay.
No, the origins of the film were in 76 when the bicentennial hoopla was going on.
I remember it well.
And I had been to a screening at the Pacific Film Archive with a few films that were a movie, Bruce Conner and Dangling Parsifal by Stan Lauder. And had found a book that compiled government propaganda films. So I approached Kevin, who was an established filmmaker, and said, why don't we make a film about propaganda and stitch it together and tell the story of America through its own propaganda? And he liked the idea, although initially initially he said, well, just gather the films and we'll splice it together. You know, it'll take a week or, I mean, your initial response was for me to go out and find the prints. And you may not remember that, but I do. But that was not the way it evolved. We ended up moving to Washington to research it in a far more substantive way. And the notion really fit Kevin's idea of cinema verite, which was the tradition that he was coming out of. And we plunged into the National Archives thinking it would be a much less elaborate project and completed the film 5 years later. It became a much
bigger,
much bigger
and
deal.
More ambitious than you knew.
And there's a transition in the middle there that Kevin can address.
Well, the first day we arrived at the National Archives, we were like kids in a candy store because there are thousands of movies that you can look at and they're available and you can make copies. And there was a guy there whose job it was to pull the films off of the shelves and bring them to us. His name was Calvin Jefferson, I believe. And
This is going to be a detail-oriented conversation.
And he said, okay, look, here's how it works. You look through the file folder, file card index here, and you figure out what you want to look at. And then you give me the list of the films. I bring them to you. You look at them. You decide what to order. And then you can go back to California tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Now, we were not planning on going back to California tomorrow. We weren't planning on staying for 5 years either. But Calvin got to know us very well. And he wasn't entirely happy because we were providing half of the work that he had to do every day.
Is he credited in the film? That's the question.
The staff was credited.
Staff of the National Archives.
This was long enough ago that you could still smoke at the National Archives.
I don't think a lot of your listeners probably don't understand this whole concept, because now,
right,
of course, you can research all the archives from your computer. You can download the footage, you know, right there instantly. And so they say, well, why did it take so long to make this movie? Well, that's one of the reasons, because then you had to have the film, and you had to look at the film, and you had to order the film, and sound.
And then editing was a much more, one could argue,
slower
process, yes. I guess. You know.
On a Steenbeck with a guillotine splicer, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Kevin, you were from the more traditional documentary background. You started, did you, in the 70s, you became a filmmaker? Is that your story?
I made student films in college, and I'd made 2 half-hour movies before doing Hurry Tomorrow. But yeah, they were documentaries that I shot with an Aton camera.
There was the beginning of a culture around verite documentary.
Starting in the early 60s, it was a revolution. I mean, this lightweight film equipment changed everything.
Thanks to Pennebaker and those guys,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right.
Leacock, Pennebaker, Wiseman a little bit later on.
Mm-hmm.
It was very exciting.
Yeah. So you wanted, that was your goal, was to...
I remember sitting at home. I was working as a janitor, actually, temporarily, and I was watching Frederick Wiseman's... basic training, and I was smoking pot, and I was looking at these mesmerizingly long shots that his great camera...
Where were you? Were you in a theater?
No, I was at home watching it on television on PBS.
Oh, right. I guess they did show some of
those. 1971. And, I'd been a bit of an athlete, and I said, boy, you know, I could do that. You know, I could hold that camera steady for 5 minutes. And you know, so he was an inspiration.
He's done this show a few times.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's been a thrill to hang out and just... So he knows you enough where you can start to joke around a little bit, because he's kind of, you know, a serious guy. But he's underneath that. There is a lot of humor, believe it or not.
Tittacat Follies thing was incredible, because he was a law professor at BU, and he brought his law class to Bridgewater State Hospital, and they just could not believe what they were seeing. You know, elderly, naked men being hosed down with high-power cold water.
You're making it hard for me to joke around. And I'm also wondering, by the way, how he's adapted that into an opera. But that's another podcast. You know about that, right?
No.
Yeah.
He came back a month later with a good cameraman and... I don't know how long he spent shooting, but, you know, he created this instant classic, Tittacat Follies.
Right.
Which was banned from screening anywhere in Massachusetts. Like, probably still is forever.
Well, that would be something he's proud of, I assume.
Yeah.
You know, especially because it's his home turf as well. But not only did a classic spring from that, but also a generation of documentary filmmakers who were, like yourself, who were inspired by that type of...
Well, it was Leacock... Pennebaker, Drew Associates, that really got it going. He kind of came in a bit later.
Yeah, that's true. And as you mentioned, the lightweight camera, as well as
the sync sound equipment.
Yeah.
Remember that guy who used to own the inn at Quogue? He had invented the sync sound, and he had the basic patent for that. And so he took all the money and went out to Quogue and bought an incredible...
Eastern Long Island. So I just wanted to get a little bit of that background, too. Because you had this... Pierce, you had the conceit just sort of dawned on you, as you described already, that it would be really amazing to tell this story through found archive of all these propaganda films and training films and...
Well, it was an excuse to unleash the inner collector in me. I mean, I've always been a sort of obsessive collector of things.
Is that right?
I still am.
Yeah. Because it's such an incredible conceit. And then it's like, why? This is this is such an obvious, powerful way to tell a story.
Well, bicentennial, I mean, the notion of propaganda was in the air, and the thought that was going through my head at the time was, why always are people talking about German propaganda? Why are all the studies of German propaganda when we were sort of awash in our own?
Yeah.
And those, and a lot of those early films, the educational type films that we saw in school, had, had a comedy built into them.
Mm-hmm.
So the notion originally was triggered by the educationals that were in Dangling Parcel, and then the government book that had them all in there, which was discovered, the 3,433 U.S. government films, and Kevin was drawn to a number of them. I mean, the one that got me was You Can't Get Away With It by the FBI, sort of different than today's. It wouldn't be the topic we'd choose right now, but anyway, it seemed as though there was a great wealth, and quick research revealed that there was a great wealth waiting to be found at the National Archives. We met on Carter's inauguration day, so we would all have a day that we could remember. We
Is
sat
that true?
Outside the we all, the three of us, met outside the National Archives, picked 9th and Pennsylvania, and said, "Just be there then, and then we'll start on the project."
One other thing I wanted to mention, which I'm reading this book now, just coincidentally, about the history of documentary, and there was a whole section, rightfully so, on Leni Riefenstahl, and I was reading how, even though, you know, she was, of course, hired or commissioned rather by Das Führer, but that others then could take the same propaganda and turn it around on itself and show why we have to fear Germany. In other words, in the mid-30s, the other European countries could take the same. It's just a perspective, an issue of perspective. So it's kind of interesting how you guys, in a sort of different way, but you end up doing the same thing where you're taking the propaganda and turning it on itself to do something very, very different, to show, you know, why we have to question what we're being fed.
Mm. I don't know if you ever saw this German propaganda film. It's called Herr Rooseveltland. And
no.
It takes all of this footage from the newsreels, which seems happy, you know, to us, people jitterbugging and things like that, and uses it to show the decadence of American culture.
Oh, okay. Similar idea then, in other words. So 1982, you finally, after 5 years, you have finished making the film. And then what? I mean, was this a big hit?
Yes, it was a big hit. It came out at the Film Forum, and immediately
it did.
Yeah,
at
well,
Film Forum.
Yes, immediately started to sell out every show.
Every show.
And on the basis of that, we got a distribution deal.
But how did that happen? I mean, they didn't have David Nin doing publicity for I don't think he's barely knee high at 40 years ago.
We hit the zeitgeist.
Okay.
It was timing.
In terms of timing, it was the height of the anti-nuke movement,
the
freeze movement.
Right.
Reagan was terrifying everybody, building up our nuclear arsenal and trying to outspend the Soviets, which he did. And people were concerned that World War III might be right around the corner. And our film just happened to come out at that time.
And we did have a great publicist. Not to take anything away from David, but
no.
We had David Fenton, who was fantastic publicist. And he was working, when we hired him, he was working for the government of Nicaragua, I believe. Right. And then he became our publicist. He'd worked for Muse, Musicians United for Safe Energy.
Oh, sure. They were big on the
no-nukes. So David was very, very helpful to us.
Okay.
And Pierce knew some people at the David Letterman show. And,
what?
So we were David had only been on the air a couple months.
Oh, yeah.
And we were some of his first guests.
Is that right?
So, yeah, you can see...
It's the 23rd show.
Yeah, you can see a very amusing clip of Pierce and I on the Letterman show.
Kevin, why didn't you get on the...
nobody told me about it.
He went on the Today Show. The next morning, we were on the Today Show.
Complaining about this. He was on the Today Show.
David Hartman. Between David Hartman and David Letterman,
they just decided he wasn't going to be articulate enough. That's what
Anyway, it was good. You can see that clip if you look
it up. It was my connection to a comedy writer there.
Let's go to the videotape, as they say.
Thank you. Welcome back to the show. The Atomic Cafe is an unusual documentary created entirely from propaganda film and newsreels of the 1940s and 50s, which tried to reassure the public and the military that the A-bomb, the atomic bomb, was something we could all survive with comparative safety. Two of the producers of the Atomic Cafe are with us, and we'll explain. This is Jane Loader and Pierce Rafferty. Thank you, folks. Is this fairly accurate, the introduction? The film is composed of propaganda film, right?
Yes.
And this was the mission to convince everybody that if one went off in the garage, no problem.
That's basically right.
Yeah. How did you get interested in this project?
Well, we discovered some years ago in San Francisco this book called 3,433 U.S. government films, and we started looking through it, and it had films like You Can't Get Away With It by the FBI. And we started to realize there was a whole wealth of this material out there that no one had ever really assembled into one package, and set out to do a film which dealt with propaganda only, and then evolved into something on the A-bomb when we saw all the material that was on that subject.
Yeah, was there anything, was it surprisingly good, surprisingly bad, or any surprises, or what you thought it would be?
Surprisingly, a lot of stuff. There was much more than we ever imagined when we started researching it.
Where did they use these films, on television or in theaters? Or
some were films for children, some were films for the military, some were films for newsreel audiences. They had films on every imaginable subject relating to the bomb, on how to use your car effectively to get out of the city quickly, on how to keep your food exactly ready to go, how to pack up
your
trunk of your
kit.
Right.
We have some a sample of what is in the motion picture Atomic Cafe, and I guess...
Great.
That was wonderful. That was very fun to watch. Okay, because I was wondering also maybe you had some champions in, maybe somebody at in the press who was championing you guys, and maybe everybody was.
Well, we were on a number of shows. I went on Mike Douglas. Lily Tomlin promoted the film because
Shame It Tonight.
Millions of dollars in press because of its timing.
Yeah,
it was
Eclipse
on 60 Minutes.
Yeah, we had a good publicist and
good
blah, blah, blah. But,
right.
Yeah,
we made
a good movie.
Yeah,
which played in theaters in 17 countries.
Yeah,
so,
but David, Vincent Canby, who was then the film critic of the New York Times, was very supportive of the film. He wrote a really good review, and then because he realized he hadn't put a good quote in, he wrote a second review, and then I think he mentioned it a third time.
It was in the Porky's review. Yeah,
in the Porky's review, he said something like, well, instead of going to see Porky's, why don't you go see the Atomic Cafe? That would be better.
Yeah. It's harder 36 years later, as I'm sure David could attest, to get the feature reviews back in there because the papers reviewed it to begin with.
Right.
Although the Times, I see, did mention it today.
What do you think of the film now as you watch it? All these years later,
we were discussing that last night, that the audiences are taking it a little more seriously, maybe than in the intervening period from when it came out up till.
Yeah.
I mean, we've hit another period when the possibility of atomic war obviously has put the subject back on the map.
And we live in a landscape of lying government officials, and this is a movie about lies.
But they were. It seemed like they. Almost just blatant and unabashed. And
lies were a little more subtle in the day.
There were rationalizations,
they were
half-truths. And
propaganda, through propaganda.
Euphemistic views of the end of the world, whereas now it's really pretty much say what you want and doesn't have any... It's untethered from the truth, absolutely, at this point. So
yeah. So where does this film... Where does it fit in the conversation? Is there a conversation?
Well, I think we're going to find out.
Yeah.
I mean, we're hoping it stimulates response.
We have a sequence about whether we should nuke Korea back during the Korean War.
Right.
And North Korea. And that's certainly something that our president has been thinking about lately,
He's threatening.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Whose button is bigger? You know,
that's
a little frightening. I think people are seriously worried right now, and you know they went through a long period of time of not being worried about the atomic bomb. So if we'd come out 5 years ago, we wouldn't be as relevant as we are today.
Right, that's right. So you were there last night at Film Forum, back at home at the Film Forum.
And we'll be there. I guess, are you going to Maine tonight?
I'm leaving, but you...
Kevin will be there for Q&A tonight.
And tomorrow
night. Tomorrow at 5,
I
think. Tonight at 7:10.
As we record this, David, where are we?
Oh, sorry.
It's okay. This is the 3rd of August, right? So it's Friday, yeah. So you'll be there Friday evening.
It'll also be opening in L.A. and San Francisco.
Tell me where, do you know? Of course
you do. Yes, I do. The Roxy in San Francisco. Okay. And in L.A., it will be at 3 Lamelies, the Pasadena one, the Santa Monica, and the Claremont.
Yeah.
You know, something that hasn't been mentioned that really led to the re-release was the Library of Congress choosing it for the National Film Registry in December of 2016. And that, in turn, because the mission of that is to preserve films for the American people, led to the 4K restoration by Indie Collect of the film and led to a distributor, Kino Lorber, being interested in handling the film domestically.
Mm-hmm.
So I think without that, we would be sitting, you know, we would not be here today.
Right. And the Library of Congress paid for the 4K restoration.
They did.
Which we are very grateful.
Very grateful, yes.
And it's actually, fantastic. If you look at the other films that are the 1982 class, it's
Porky's,
Tootsie, Raiders of the Lost Ark, E.T., Chan is Missing and Us. I think that's it. There's only 5 films.
Wow, so, yeah, that's pretty amazing.
They choose 25 a year. Yeah. What I liked was that Atomic Cafe was listed alphabetically, so we were first.
Right at the top.
You had to skip over Bo Bremel, but then you hit the Birds. I mean, you know, we were in distinguished company.
Oh, very I see. Good, in the overall
list of 25.
Oh.
No, in the list
every
of 25.
Every year they choose 25.
They choose them from the past.
They do.
I see. And so far, I guess they've chosen more than 700 out of the approximately 1 million films that have been made. So, I mean, initially when I heard about it, when I asked about what this meant for me, I said, well, great one-liner for my obituary, but I didn't realize they were going to preserve the film. And and so that was a far more significant contribution, the fact that the Library of Congress was willing to, or does that for films. It's great.
Yeah.
Thank goodness, right? We still have...
Yes, that they're still able to fund films.
That is a
It's an interesting list. I mean, you got, you know, Casablanca and The Wizard of Oz, but you've also got This Is Menstruation, 1946. I mean,
To its credit, that's a classic.
Okay.
Some of the Jim Handy classics are on there.
Right. Rick Prellinger was on the committee for a long time.
He got some really interesting documentary educationals in there.
Yeah.
So you'll have some of the early Edison films are on there, obviously. So.
Right. And I assume there's all sorts of reasons why films are selected, not just popular appeal or box office or what have you.
Quality.
Well,
there's a committee, and I think people send in records. I mean, there is some sort of lobbying by the public.
There is. The public is allowed to submit their choices, and the Atomic Cafe was nominated.
I'm just curious, though. A lot of people saw Atomic Cafe, and you know, why didn't you follow up? Like,
you mean as the three of us?
Yeah.
Well, I think we were ready to go our separate ways at that point, and I wrote a novel, a collection of short stories, which were both published by Grove Press. Oh. You know, Pierce founded a stock footage archive.
I actually did have another deal, much maybe to everyone else's here at the table's irritation, but I had a deal briefly with Norman Lear to do the same sort of film about sex ed films and sort of failed at doing that, but it was taken over and released as a totally different film with a narration called Heavy Petting. But I, you know, they credit me with writing it or something. But originally we had the deal and then switched over to running a film archive and starting a film archive in New York, which was sort of in the meat market, which was parallel to Rick Prelinger's operation in the meat market for 10 years.
Yeah, you should understand, like, for 5 years, a lot of that 5 years, we all lived together in the same house. So we were really ready to go our separate ways by the end of the 5-year period.
I see. Where was this?
It was in Arlington, Virginia.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right on Highway 50. If you went one way, you could end up in Nevada. You went the other way, you went downtown Washington. And in the fall, the leaves on the slick road would cause car crashes outside.
God. Really?
And there was talk at one point of setting up a sound-activated camera to capture some of these crashes.
That could have been your follow-up film.
Well, it could have been.
You know? Well, just to remind everybody, the Atomic Cafe is going to be screening for a couple of weeks. At least it has a 2-week run at the newly, by the way, restored Film Forum. No, but the film forum has also just opened its doors. In fact, your film is the inaugural, one of the inaugural films that are at the new film forum. So we'll keep people abreast of also where else they're going to see it in the West Coast. And then is there a plan, just real briefly, do you know, is there a plan to re-release this on other platforms?
I think first they'll do the theatrical repertory.
Yes. Right, of course.
Pierce was just telling me how many dates do they have already booked.
David would know 18 or seem to be booked.
Yeah. So
18 venues.
I know we're going to be in Chicago.
So it's going to go wide. Over the course of the late summer into the fall, I guess, mm-hmm. right? Makes sense.
Yes.
And then maybe they'll re-release. It makes sense to re-release it right now.
I'm assuming it's going to be on Netflix, and the reason I know that is because the old DVD on Netflix, and they just, knowing that we were doing the 4K, they just removed it.
It makes sense. Well, it also makes sense in light of that if it's going to come out theatrically, it makes sense for both sides, Netflix and Kino and everybody, to not have it mm-hmm. available so easily
right.
on your phone. or wherever people watch things like that. Listen, guys, it was great meeting you all, and I wish you the best and with the Atomic Cafe and everything else. It was really great meeting you guys.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Now, this seems so silly. Did the government actually believe what they were telling us, or did they not know, and so they chose to make everything seem to be relatively harmless?
Well, I don't think they believed it. I think they consciously, especially with the soldiers, consciously tried to reassure them so that they would do as they were ordered, mm-hmm. which is to, participate in these atomic bomb explosions, which endanger their health when they're now getting cancer from...
Yeah, but the point is, did they know there were negative things going on, or were they just assuming that there would be questions and people would be worried, so they produced these things?
It's hard to prove.
Yeah.
It's very hard to prove. I think they knew, and a lot of evidence is coming out now that would support that contention, but it's impossible at this point to say.
The scientists, for example, wore suits at a lot of these tests where the soldiers marched into the blast area. All the GIs just had regular clothing. This is 25 years ago, 20 years ago.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. Have you liked our Facebook page, facebook.com/filmwaxradio? Do so. And get on our newsletter. You can subscribe to it very easily. Just go to our homepage on our website, filmwaxradio.com. Bookmark that page. page, too, while you're at it. And while you're there, if you go to the archives, you can get every episode of Film Wax Radio, going back to episode number one, which I believe was in about September 2011. So it's going on 7 years in a few weeks. It's pretty mind-boggling now that I mention it. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. So follow us there as well. YouTube. Now, here's the thing. Go to the iTunes page. Go to iTunes Store and search Film Wax or Film Wax Radio or my name. And leave us a review and a star rating if you would. If you don't have a iTunes account and you don't have an iPhone or an iPad or an iBook or an iMac or what have you, just go to Stitcher, which is my recommended podcast app, and you can do the same there. We're on Stitcher. Thank you, everybody. We'll be back in a few days on Thursday with episode 502, where we're going to celebrate this new film, beautiful film called We the Animals. We're going to have the director, Jeremiah Zegar. We're going to have lead actor, my friend Raul Castillo, and we're going to have the cinematographer of the film, Zach Mulligan, all on the podcast next episode. Also on the same episode, Film Wax Radio friend Frank Mosley, actor, filmmaker. The Spectacle Theater in Brooklyn, Williamsburg, is going to be presenting a retrospective of Frank's directorial efforts. There's going to be a feature and three short films that he directed, and they're all going to be played over the course of several weeks at the Spectacle Theater. Frank will be in town at Brooklyn to meet his audience on Saturday, the 25th of August, and I hope to catch up with him there that evening at the Spectacle Theater. So look up the Spectacle Theater in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. We'll have Frank on the next episode of the podcast. After that, we have an episode with Film Wax friend Larry Fessenden back for his sixth visit. And we're going to have on the actor Trina Durholm, who's just marvelous in Nico 1988, as well as Amy Scott, the director of Hal, a documentary about the beloved 70s director, Hal Ashby, and so much more. Thank you for listening. My name is Adam Chartoff. The name of this podcast is Film Wax Radio. Thank you for tuning in and for subscribing. Take care of yourself and the ones you love. Broken lines, broken strings, broken threads, broken springs, broken idols, broken heads.